Right, we continue in our study on lies the world tells. Tonight we're going to be looking at treason and religious liberty. Probably just call it treason, because I've used one word titles for all the other lectures, and so I'm trying to keep consistent. But really, we'll be looking at treason and religious liberty, and hopefully you'll see the significance of that as we unpack it a bit more. The American War of Independence was an act of treason according to King George III. This was treason taking place across here in the colonies. R.J. Rushdoony, in his book, The Nature of the American System, says that John Adams cited the attempt of Parliament to force the establishment of the Church of England on the colonies as responsible as much as any other cause for the break with England. So as much as any other cause that caused the war, John Adams said it was this taking of the Anglican faith and trying to force that practice, that method of worshipping God upon the churches in the colonies. Religion was a fundamental cause of the war, we see. As Rushdoony says, every colony had its own form of Christian establishment or settlement. Everyone was a particular kind of Christian republic. It was to them a monstrous idea for an alien body, the English Parliament, to impose an establishment upon them. The colonies were by history and nature Christian. The concept of a secular state was virtually non-existent in 1776 as well as in 1787. Some of the young guys, what was 1776? Okay, the Declaration of Independence. And one of the younger guys for 1787? 1787 was when the drafting of the Constitution. So you had Declaration of Independence 1776 and then the drafting of the Constitution in 1787, some 11 years later. Remember, the Constitution is what grants authority to the Congress or federal government. That's what they did. They said, drafting this Constitution is going to give authority to the federal government, and thus, what's not granted in the Constitution, they cannot do. That's basically how the Constitution functions. We're telling you what you can. What's not in there is off limits, so we don't have to cover everything. You can't assume that for yourselves. And to further underline the fact that the federal authorities were to stay totally out of legislating on matters of religion, the First Amendment was drafted, which is, Congress shall make no laws respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So the Congress cannot influence and impact the religious practice of the states. There is nothing here about separation of church and state. It's saying that the federal government, the Congress, cannot make any laws with respect to this. It's not saying let's separate them. Congress was barred from either establishing or prohibiting religion, i.e. any way of influencing or dictating the religious practice in any state. As Rushdoony says, the freedom of the First Amendment from federal interference is not from religion, freedom from religion, but freedom for religion. That's what the purpose of the First Amendment was. Freedom for religion in all the states. The amendment was guided toward that point, to preserve the religion that was there. It was for the protection of religious freedom and not for the stifling of it. So Rushdoony continues, the establishment and the settlements in the states were definitely and specifically Christian. They were religious requirements for citizenship. You couldn't become a citizen of the state unless you met these certain religious requirements. There were religious requirements for suffrage, which means to vote you had to attain a certain level of religious profession. There were religious oaths, laws prohibiting blasphemy, laws requiring a Trinitarian faith or a firm belief in the infallibility of Scripture, and laws barring unbelievers as witnesses in court. If you were an unbeliever, you were not allowed to witness in court. How do you take an oath? How do you say, I swear, put your hand on the Bible and swear if you're an unbeliever? So there would be a law, sorry, you're incapable of giving evidence. The laws were premised on the fact, this is continuous question, the laws were premised on the fact that the respective states were Christian, and anti-Christianity constituted treasonable activity or belief. The basis of the state being Christian, that foundation had to be protected legally. So because we're Christians, we're going to protect ourselves according to God's truth and God's law. And so that's what they did. We are confronted in this historical account with two very different ideas about treason. King George's idea and the colonists' idea of what treason was. That for which King George was a matter of treason, for the colonists was a matter of religious freedom. Thus we see that religious freedom and treason are very closely related, and you're going to find them together the whole time, both on the positive side and on the negative side. Were the writers of the First Amendment seeking to protect religious freedom in general? Absolutely not. There was not religious freedom that they were trying to protect in general. The religious freedom that they were enshrining and that they were protecting was Christianity, nothing else. What did the states understand by the term religious freedom when you consider their laws regulating citizenship and the right to vote? So what do you think they understood by religious freedom? It was only Christianity. If you were not a Christian, you could not become a citizen of the state. If you're not a Christian, you could not vote. Yet today we know the First Amendment is thought to grant equal standing and rights to all religions, and many Christians promote this idea of a general religious freedom as a foundational pillar of Christianity. That is one of the foundational pillars of Christianity, is that we have religious freedom, which means all religions become equal. Not in the Christian's eyes, but in society where we live. It cannot be. Rather, this is a sign of our age's inability to think that they even consider this kind of religious freedom as possible. If you just had to sit down and think about it carefully, you'd realize this is an impossibility. How do we have religious freedom for everybody? So I ask, does an undefined religious freedom exist anywhere? Or can it exist anywhere? You know, okay, maybe we haven't arrived at it yet, but yes, one day we're going to arrive at that. An undefined religious freedom for everybody. Is it a possibility of existing? What would it look like in the dusty realities of living day-to-day life? What would it look like? Who would decide what to exclude or what to include? I believe it's been a very clever move by the secular mind to promote the idea that true freedom means all religions are granted equal status. Because in doing this, they've silenced all religions and made the secular mind the ultimate source of morality. You see, when you make all these religions equal, they're all equally silenced. And they're relegated, for the most part. They're reduced to personal little existence in your heart. And Christianity is reduced to a personal existence in your heart. And now we, the secular state or the secular mind, will legislate what's acceptable, even from the Christian religion, what's not acceptable. And in each religion, we'll define and we will lay up and show you what is and what isn't going to be. And then the secular mind becomes the highest law in all the details of life. And men religiously hold to their moral choices and decisions, which we will see. Politicians today religiously hold to their positions. Secular humanism promotes the equality of religions and limits their relevance to a spiritual realm, because the secular humanist wants the morality of his religion to say what is and what isn't useful from all the other religions when it comes to secular affairs. So we've reduced all that. All the religions are reduced to their little spiritual faith thing that floats around, and now we're laying down what the secular state does, and we legislate for all those areas. But when did the Lord relinquish his lordship? When did he say, I'm no longer the Lord? Because the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. All things still belong to him, and he demands conformity to his every word. If people are going to be going to hell because they did not obey the Lord while they walked on this earth, it means his law and his principles are enforced now. And it is those principles that they violated while they walked on this earth, and therefore they are going to hell. It's because that law is unchanging. True Christianity necessarily excludes all other standards of morality and truth. The second commandment forbids bowing down or even serving anything other than God. That is, we are to live by every word from his mouth. We cannot bow down and serve anything else. And that's what it's talking about. Thou shalt have no other gods before me, nor must we bow down and serve them, which means as soon as we listen to another word other than God's, we are serving something other than God. So who is exempt from this? Because unfortunately, many in the church believe that, well, seeing as that's an unbeliever, he must be exempt from everything God expects. So nobody is exempt from God's standards, and his standards constantly there. Does rebellion against God excuse you from obeying him? Obviously not. When someone says in their heart that there is no God, does that mean God's eternal standard of morality is put on hold until that person acknowledges that God is Lord? And then once I acknowledge God is Lord, then I'm accountable to his deeds. He destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah because of that very principle. Every religion other than Christianity is a perversion of God's truth and an attempt to escape from and overthrow his demands. Christianity, when it is true to Scripture, supports God's truth and glory, whereas every other religion, including secular humanism, is out to destroy God's truth and glory. Every religion is out to attain supremacy for itself. And I believe the way the humanists have done that is to exalt and equate all religions and say we want religious freedom for everybody, and we promote that because once we do that, then we can limit that to a very personal, spiritual little sphere and let us deal with the real matters of life. And so they grant that so that they can regulate all other religions. When a religion cannot fully practice its teachings, it is being regulated. And the regulator is the supreme religion of the land. So whoever's regulating, whatever practices a religion can function, that becomes the supreme religion of the land, of that society. What America fought for in the War of Independence was for the freedom of the Christian religion and not for freedom of religion in general. Freedom of religion in general is impossible. Which religion do we give freedom to, and how free do we allow their religion to be? How free do we allow them to be? Who determines what is and isn't appropriate in that religion's religious expression? Baal worshippers, for example. How free do we allow them to practice their religion? They're sincerely religious. Do we allow human sacrifice if their religion requires it? Do we allow their fertility, immorality aspects of promoting the fertility of the land and all the perversions that they do? Do we allow that because that's part of their religion? How do we give the Muslims freedom of religion when holy jihad against the infidel is an integral and fundamental part of their religion? Oh, no, we can have religious freedom here. You're allowed to come and worship. How can we allow those things? Human sacrifice. We could make this list very long, pointing out the inconsistencies of religions and what we would allow them to practice. But you get the point. Thus, it's extremely poor thinking when Christians think that general religious freedom actually exists in the USA and is something that they ought to be promoting. I've heard people say that. This is all the wonderful thing about this nation is that we have all these religions and we all have this freedom to believe and do exactly as we want. General religious freedom means the destruction of Christianity. What is treason? Treason in a secular sense. Treason has a bad ring about it. Why? Betrayal of the nation. It's kind of a huge and massive thing. Treason is the undermining of the whole nation, as opposed to a guy doing a crime on the side fringes somewhere. But treason is affecting the very body that consists of the nation. It's the most serious assault against a nation. It's an attempt to overthrow the very foundation pillars of a nation and thus bring the whole nation crashing down. That's what treason is. What is the most fundamental pillar in the Christian nation? God. That's the most fundamental pillar, upholding. Now, if you want a picture, you want to see this pillar standing, and on top of that sits the Christian nation. And that pillar is God. That is the most fundamental pillar. Thus, if God's person and truth are allowed to be distorted in that nation is allowing an act of treason against its very foundation, which if unchecked will bring about the ruin of that nation. King George cried treason when men rebelled against his will. Whereas the American colonies said King George was the one committing treason against the God of the Bible. The God of the Bible was actually the foundation pillar of their states, and therefore they stood firm and stood upon that and would rather be committing treason against man than God. King George attempted to control their worship, which was a blatant violation of their Christian freedom, and thus they determined to commit treason against man rather than against God. You see, the foundation for true freedom and liberty is Christianity. Full stop. Nothing else. There's absolutely nothing else that can provide freedom and liberty other than Christianity. And so this idea that we can allow all these different ideas to flourish and promote them, or not promote them, but just allow them to flourish and express themselves, is a confused aspect in our thinking. Somehow we see it as a great measure of graciousness. Everything else produces bondage and ultimately destruction. The founding fathers understood what a Christian nation looked like and how to preserve it. Christianity was the only acceptable religion. That's it. There's no debate. We're not going to apologize for that. We're not going to argue about it. That's a fact. And we legislate accordingly. So that was the only acceptable form of religion, though the exact manifestation of that, of Christianity, was not legislated. That's what the First Amendment is doing. He's saying we're not going to have a civil government or a Congress legislating which exact manifestation or demonstration of Christianity is going to be the national norm. So we can have Methodists, we can have Anglican, we can have Presbyterians, we can have all these different expressions of Christianity, but fundamentally Christianity is what is taught. So the sovereignty of God, the upholding God and His truth and the authority of His word. So that is the freedom of religion that they promoted. Only Christians could become citizens and vote. Blasphemy was illegal, and there were other biblical laws that they applied. John Calvin understood this principle of treason against God and what that would mean for a Christian state. However, in almost every book you will read of Calvin's life, even if it's a guy who likes Calvin, when he gets to the issue with Servetus, who was executed, he's going to come down and he's going to criticize Calvin's part in that. And he's going to say, well, you know, we all have our blind spots. And often they'll come in this condescending way. We've got to put Calvin in his day and understand he was a man of his age. And let's move on. And, you know, unfortunately, that's what John Calvin did. Unenlightened times, that's the implication. And we're so much more enlightened, so much more gracious. We've learned so much more about these wonderful things of liberty and freedom so that we can shake our heads in pity at this man. Briefly, Michael Servetus was a very clever man who lived to attacking the God of the Bible. And one of his main attacks was against the triune nature of God. And so, you know, he's attacking Christ and Christ's eternity and eternal being. So he's attacking the Trinity and he's writing tomes of stuff and distributing it. He was condemned in a number of cities, Roman Catholic and Protestant cities, for his writings. And he had just escaped from a Roman Catholic city where he would have been sentenced to death because of this. And he managed to escape. And he came to Geneva partly to cause trouble, because there was a group of people in Geneva that hated Calvin. They hated him because of his religious belief and because of what his religion meant to that city. You need to remember that the leaders of Geneva, of the city, the we talk about city here, but in a sense you've got to think nation. They were little nations, but which was no bigger than a city. So Geneva was a nation in and of itself, self-contained and everything. So the city had its leaders, its politicians, and they did not like John Calvin. They did not like his theology. They did not understand his theology. But they recognized his theology brought stability and prosperity and increased the city tremendously. And so we need John Calvin. And so they had kicked him out at one stage and they brought him back. And so he was serving in that city. You've got to understand the political situation going on there. He was not liked by the politicians. Some of these history books will tell you, and particularly if you pick up like an encyclopedia and you flip to John Calvin, and some of them will go so far as to say he was this iron-fisted tyrant who ruled Geneva. And you think, you know, let's even get a little bit of historical perspective here. Calvin, he wasn't allowed to become a citizen. These politicians were not allowed to become a citizen of Geneva until December 25th, 1559, some 4 years before he died. This whole incident with Civitas was in 1553, way before he was even considered a citizen. So he had no power and control. His influence was just by preaching the word and people responding to the truth. And so Civitas arrives in Geneva, called in by this other radical group that's trying to oust Calvin and get him out of the city. And they want Civitas to stir up the trouble and create all kinds of political turmoil. And he gets recognized, and the city arrests him. Not John Calvin. The city arrests him, and then they ask Calvin to come in and give evidence. Is this blasphemy? Indeed, this is blasphemy. This attacking the Trinity is definitely a violation of extreme proportions. It's attacking the very foundation of society. It's attacking the very foundation of our city, of our nation. And if we allow this to go unchecked, this whole nation will come crumbling down. So this is a fundamental assault. This is a treasonous assault against the foundations. Yes, he deserves to die. It was a 3-month trial. And Calvin consulted with all the other reformers he was in touch with, and they all consented. This is a treasonable offense. He needs to die. The city sentenced Civitas to death by burning, and Calvin pled with them. He said, please, let's just execute him, let's just hang him or whatever. Let's make it a quick, simple death. And they told him to get lost. Who does he think he is? He's not even a citizen. Don't come and interfere in our affairs. We've made our ruling. And he spent a lot of time with Civitas trying to evangelize him, trying to preach the gospel to him and get him to recant and also to believe in the true Christ, but he refused to. He continued with his abusive activities. Also, what you need to understand is that the law that Geneva functioned under, the Justinian Code, which had been in operation in the whole of the Holy Roman Empire for hundreds of years, this was the law books. This was it that they were using. And so they judged him according to that Justinian Code and said, this Justinian Code means death. So they upheld that. And so now Calvin is pinned with this. He is guilty of Civitas' death for agreeing that what Civitas had done was worthy of death. He is attributed with killing Civitas almost. So you need to be careful when you're reading books. In fact, many Reformed people have gone and built some kind of memorial in Geneva as an apology to Civitas on behalf of John Calvin, kind of on the behalf of the Reformed people. Sorry, we totally misunderstood this situation. Who's misunderstood the situation is them. They failed to realize what was taking place there. They failed to realize that this was an assault against the very foundation of society. And when you attack the foundation of a Christian society, it's coming down if it is not defended. Civitas is maliciously and repeatedly throwing attacks against the person of God to distort who God is in a malicious way and promote that is to destroy the lives of that people and the whole society. So a malicious attack on God is treason. And a Christian nation, if it is to remain a Christian nation, has to defend itself against all acts of treason. So if you come across the account of Calvin, you need to put it into perspective as to really what took place there and what was going on. And then you need to understand the treason that Calvin saw with the treason, as I'm trying to explain it tonight, and the whole understanding of religious liberty. We are not to apologize for the truth of Christianity, nor embrace an anemic, politically correct opinion of what Christianity looks like. We need to teach biblical truth with authority. So too many times when we're speaking the truth or we're bringing biblical truth, because the people are rejecting it, we kind of feel apologetic about that. We're feeling that, I suppose they're not believers and, you know, one day maybe. No, but the truth is only one truth, and we need to realize that and stand upon it. This is God's world. You know, it's like, it would be like a child in a home speaking to his friend and saying, no, we don't do that in our home. I know what my father's standards are. This is what we do. and to say that with authority. We do not do that. And we are the same. This is God's world. We don't apologize. We don't need to feel embarrassed about His standards and His ways. And say, oh yeah, well, if that's how you feel you want to worship, that's fine. No, that's wrong. That's error. Now, obviously, you've got to realize getting from where we are now to a Christian nation is not a simple move. And I'm not suggesting that that's an overnight action. It's not a revolution we enter into. There's a progression and a growth, and it takes time. But that's the goal we're aiming at. We can't be thinking that religious toleration, as we know it in the United States, is a good thing. It's a pagan idea. It's a very at the very core of undermining the beliefs that we are promoting. So we need to teach biblical truth with authority and apply it to our families without apology, apply it wherever we go without apology. But remember, our presentation of the truth is never to be without the fruit basket, which is the fruit of the Spirit. So we're not to be aggressive and present it in an unloving way, but at the same time, we present it firmly. Everyone in a Christian nation is subject to the civil, moral laws and judgments of that nation. So if we had a Christian nation, everyone would be subject to those laws. We would not apologize for those laws. We would say, well, if you don't like these laws, there's many other countries to go live in. But as Israel was supposed to be, they were supposed to be a nation that lived these laws of God. And by living these laws, the other nations were supposed to look at them and say, wow, look at those laws. Look at the peace and prosperity. Look, what is the laws that you follow? What is the God that has given you these laws? That's what we're supposed to be. And as a Christian nation, that would be an attractive thing to other nations. But you would have to apply these principles of Christianity. Otherwise, you're going to be overwhelmed, which is what America has done. America, in a large degree, has had a very solid Christian base. God has blessed her with prosperity. The rest of the world has flooded in, and they've given green cards on a lottery basis, which is the idea of generosity and helping the poor in some kind of way, I imagine. And thousands upon thousands have just poured into this nation with a completely different world and life view, with a completely different agenda, with some of them, the Muslim groups and others, with a very focused religious objective to undermine and destroy this nation and turn it into a Muslim country. And we've said, no, we're freedom of religion. Come in and worship and believe exactly as you want. And so we're destroying ourselves because of lack of knowledge, because we haven't followed basic principles in Scripture, that God is a jealous God, the earth is the Lord's, and we are not to tolerate foolish ideas and distortion of who God is. But God is a jealous God. When Satan tempted Jesus, Satan said, all these things I will give to you if you will fall down and worship me. Okay, I'll give you great bounty. Then Jesus said to him, away with you, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve. Him only. That's the only one who's allowed to be served in this world. At any time in its history, whether now or whether into the future, God is the only one who's allowed to be served. And the way we serve Him is according to His truth and upholding that truth, and therefore we do not apologize for it. And this touches everything. We see King Asa understood this very well, and he wouldn't tolerate any rivals to the Lord. We read in 2 Chronicles 14 verses 2 through 5. Asa did what was good and right in the eyes of the Lord his God. For he removed the altars of the foreign gods and the high places, and broke down the sacred pillars, and cut down the wooden images. He commanded Judah to seek the Lord God of their fathers, and to observe the law and the commandment. He also removed the high places and the incense altars from the cities of Judah, and the kingdom was quiet under him. He's cleaning out. He's not only courting the people to worship God, but he's cleaning out all the pagan things that they had set up and the different places to worship, the pillars and the groves and the trees that they would plant and go and worship God. We see Josiah does the same thing in 2 Chronicles 34, verses 3 through 4, where he destroyed and wiped out all the false ways of relating to God and proclaiming Him. So I've raised some difficult issues maybe in thought. The application is very difficult, and there needs to be lots of wrestling and thinking through these issues. But we need to get these main pillars in line, and until we get those, we're not going to be able to fit in the other details as to how it all connects and functions. But we need to realize that we are called for the objective of a Christian nation as the goal. I believe that's where America was in its founding, and it has left that. And if, as we look back, we can see many points along the way why America has drifted. And family is significant, the teaching and instruction of the families, but teaching these things as to the importance of upholding Christianity and not apologizing for it.
Would you maybe comment on a distinction that you would see here between how that nation would view the stranger as opposed to making that stranger somehow compel himself to believe something within the nation?
Right. The founding fathers understood that when they would not give the vote and they would not give citizenship, but but you would not give the stranger the vote or possibility to have influence and authority. But you receive him in. But at the same time, he's got to realize that he is subject to the laws of this nation. You don't come in here and now start to set up your own practices. You're subject to the laws of the nation, and these are the laws with respect to what you can and can't do, what you can and can't say about God. So we're not going to force you to believe Christianity. We're going to be gracious to you. We're going to evangelize you. But until there's true fruit in your life and clear evidence of a true repentance, there is no authority mechanism that you can have. And therefore, when a stranger refuses to comply, and so he's bucking the system, I think then you can tell him, thanks very much, we can send you back to your wonderful nation that is so rich and prosperous where you ran away from. So you can do that. He's not a citizen. So you can say, thank you, you've outstayed your welcome, just as you would do that to a guest in your home who didn't abide by the rules of your home if you brought them in and they were bucking your system, trying to undermine what you were doing, whether it be your mother who came into your home to give her protection and she's undermining the faith of the family, say, sorry, Mom, you're out of here. Okay, so Christianity is not emotional. If you're going to undermine the very thing we're trying to build, you know, I'm not saying that one day she says, oh, I don't like going to church, and you say, hey, hit the street. I'm talking about the seditious thing where the mother is undermining the faith of your children, you know, so you're teaching your children, and she's coming in there and undermining it. You say, this is impossible, it cannot work. Sorry, Mom, you're going to have to go and find somewhere else to stay. My prior responsibility here is to God and to my children and to uphold His righteousness, and if you can't bow to these laws, then I'm sorry, you're gone. And that will be the same in a nation as well. For we welcome the stranger to come in, but he realizes when he comes in, he's subject to our laws and our standards. And if he doesn't like that, that's fine. We're not forcing him. He can go back. You're free to leave at any time you want. It's not like Islam. We don't force conversion. So you're receiving a stranger in as not a believer, and the basis there is evangelistic purposes. But the whole time he needs to understand, if he's coming in with his agenda to undermine your foundation, then he's got problems. I would say that there could be no public expressions of their worship and no proselytizing of their religion. So he can believe what he wants in his heart, but if you're going to be in this nation, these are the laws. You can't undermine your foundation and survive as a people. You're free to come in, but you're not free to proselytize. In Israel, it was even a generational thing where certain people groups couldn't become citizens or Israelites until a certain number of generations. So, you know, it's not like as soon as you cross the border, you're welcome to partake of and benefit in all the blessings and the riches of our nation. And we're willing to share with you, and we're willing to love you and be gracious to you. But until there's generational evidence of true conversion, we're not giving you the vote where you can turn things upside down and the whole time you're expected to abide by our laws. So I believe that's how you would protect yourself. I think there has to be a franchise. There's some qualification needed in order to vote. Not just 18 years of age, where you've demonstrated responsibility and ability to think. Yes, we believe people have freedom and liberties, but it's bound by the law. Until we stop apologizing for Christianity and God's standard and thinking, you know, well, it really is an oppressive thing to apply biblical law on people. Imagine that. I mean, imagine how oppressive that would be if we were honorable and people of integrity. Well, because we've thrown out the law, so we don't have a standard that we can point people to. So we don't know what love looks like. We don't know what justice looks like. We don't know what any of these things look like because we've become a law unto ourselves. And so we've got nothing to offer. We think every religion is a sincere manifestation of man just wanting to be a nice guy. That's what we think. That's how we see religions. We do not see everything, including secular humanism, to the Muslim, to all the false religions. They are a self-conscious assault against the only true religion. And they're all vying for their own supremacy. That's what they want, dominance. And the Muslims are most forthright with that. They want dominance, and they unapologetically proclaim that, and they're heading for it. And so you've got the radicals in the Muslims, who everybody's afraid of, and the moderates, who might not quite understand everything that's going on, but hey, they're not going to criticize a Muslim brother, because either he could end up hurting you, or it's just a bad thing to do. And so they keep quiet, and so the Muslims gain more and more authority and influence. And then eventually the moderates step up to the plate. So you need to understand that the Quran, they will show you verses that will say that Muhammad will talk about loving your neighbor and being gracious to him. And then there's other passages that will talk about holy jihad and absolutely exterminating the infidel. The Quran also says that any latest statement of Muhammad, because they realized there were contradictions and he changed his opinions, the latest statement that Muhammad made if there's two statements he made, the later one is the authoritative one. The other one disappears, really. So although it's still in the Quran, the later one is the one that has authority. Now, if you realize Muhammad's life, the early part of his life, he was a minority. This Muslim faith was trying to grow and it was struggling. And he taught at that point, he taught this graciousness of loving your enemies and being kind. The second part of Muhammad's life, when he assumed power and authority, was when he was in control militarily and had dominion and just crushed his enemies. And that's when he was teaching the second part. So, a consistent Muslim, he's going to flash at the Western world, no, but look how we teach love and we teach tolerance. But he knows in his mind, this thing down here is what has authority, and that's what we're banking it on. And the Western world says, oh no, this is a peaceful religion. And they're saying, you are such a bunch of idiots. This is wonderful. This is easier than taking candy from infants. And our media is bowing over backwards to promote them and doing all it can to defend them. And you've got a jihad war declared in a military base, and you've got the media defending him. Don't judge the religion by one man's actions. But, and I don't know about you, but I was extremely encouraged last night when I was seeing those families and many large families being introduced and realizing what God is doing. It's a powerful force. It really is. So may the Lord keep us faithful in doing what we're doing and realize we're going to have an impact. This is critical work, and although we can't see it yet and all we see at the moment are kind of gathering storm clouds, we need to realize that by faith, as we stick to what we've been given to do, the great victory is going to be ours. And God can turn a nation in a moment if He's got faithful people. Well, why don't we spend some time in prayer over these things?